I have in front of me a letter. It's titled A Pastoral Letter to the Catholic Faithful of the Diocese of Colorado Springs on the Duties of Catholic Politicians and Voters. Now, you might have heard about this. This was headlines in today's paper. It's also headlines all across the nation. Bishop bans pro-choice voters from communion. Colorado Springs Bishop says Catholics who vote for pro-choice, pro-gay marriage polls jeopardize their salvation. That language taken from the letter that comes from the Bishop of Colorado Springs. And we're going to be talking about that here. That's the Most Reverend Michael J. Sheridan. We're going to be talking about this with Dr. James Hitchcock here in the first 20 minutes of Issues Etc. today. And setting it in the context of the November election, setting in the context of the broader American Roman Catholic scene. And of course, what has the Vatican had to say about this? The letter that I referenced there has several footnotes citing John Paul II, particularly from both the Catechism, a document that bears his imprimatur, and the document, The Gospel of Life. We'll find out what that's all about during the first 20 minutes of Issues Etc. today. Peter LaBarbara joins us a little later in this hour to talk about gay marriage in Illinois. Yesterday, we talked about the prospect of gay marriage in Missouri with Jim Lemke. Peter LaBarbara, Executive Director of the Illinois Family Institute, will join us to talk about the Illinois side of the issue. Then to round off this first hour and a little bit into the second hour, Pastor Joe Fisher will join us. Perhaps you saw the story in USA Today. This story has actually been around for about a week, well, even more than a week, and we've been following it. But it hit USA Today and the Associated Press. Pastor Joe Fisher is quoted in those stories. He's pastor of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in West Bend, Wisconsin. He spent 3 years battling the Wisconsin Department of Corrections on the issue of whether or not prison inmates in Wisconsin should be able to drink wine when receiving the Lord's Supper. Well, he's in favor of them receiving the Lord's Supper according to Christ's institution. We'll have him make the case there from about 3:30 till 4:30. We have open lines after that for your questions and your comments. Running into the third hour, we'll hear from Joel Osteen. Joel Osteen, pastor of the largest megachurch in the United States down in Houston, Texas. I think he is the shape of things to come. We're going to hear what he says himself. Hear what the cutting edge of megachurch preaching sounds like during open lines, and your questions and your comments, anything you want to talk about during that hour. Then in the last 30 minutes of the program, you may have seen the op-ed piece under the heading of Morality, No Cause or Religion Justifies Heinous Treatment. We'll have Dr. Alvin Schmidt to talk about that op-ed piece and about the true face of Islam in the last 30 minutes of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. James Hitchcock is a regular guest here on the program. He's professor of history at St. Louis University. He joins us to talk about a recent statement of the Bishop of Colorado Springs that voters should not receive communion if they are pro-choice and pro-gay marriage. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back.
Thank you. Seems like I'm here an awful lot.
Yes, the news seems to be coming again and again. We have found another courageous bishop, have we?
Yes, I was really very surprised, because it seems to me Bishop Sheridan has now, you might say, advanced the discussion another stage. He has included voters in saying that people who vote for pro-abortion candidates or people who favor stem cell research or who favor euthanasia, that those who vote should not receive communion. That, as I say, is a step beyond what previous bishops had done.
He seems also to be responding, in part at least, to some of the rhetoric from Roman Catholic politicians that in an effort to honor the separation of church and state, they are at liberty to say, I'm Roman Catholic, but to vote, legislate, write laws contrary to the church's teaching.
Yes,
on life.
Bishop Sheridan has a discussion in there of conscience, which, as he points out, is one of the great misused words. A number of people seem to use the word conscience to basically mean, if it seems all right to me, it's all right. As he points out, conscience is rooted in an objective situation of right and wrong, and you have an obligation to inform yourself of objective right and wrong.
Now, here is the statement that probably...
Hello?
Are you still there, Dr. Hitchcock?
Hello?
we will get Dr. Hitchcock back. Apparently some trouble on his end of the phone. Now, the statement that I was going to reference there, while we await Dr. Hitchcock's return, this is strong language. You got to listen to this, folks. It says, "There must be no confusion in these matters. Any Catholic politicians who advocate for abortion, for illicit stem cell research, or for any form of euthanasia, ipso facto, place, that is, by the very fact, place themselves outside full communion with the Church, and so jeopardize their salvation. Any Catholics who vote for candidates who stand for abortion, illicit stem cell research, or euthanasia suffer the same fateful consequences. It is for this reason that these Catholics, whether candidates for office or those who should vote for them, may not receive Holy Communion until they have recanted their positions and been reconciled with God and the Church in the sacrament of penance." This is a call for repentance, as well as a, I guess the Church would call it, a minor ban on those who both make the laws, bring them into being through their legislative powers, and those who vote for those lawmakers. I'd like your thoughts on this as well. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We will have Dr. Hitchcock back presently. A reminder that a little bit later in this hour, Peter LaBarbera will join us to talk about gay marriage in Illinois, a tie-in to this, not so much on the Roman Catholic issue, but it's one of the issues raised by Bishop Sheridan that Roman Catholic lawmakers cannot abrogate the issue of gay marriage. I think he lists abortion, illicit stem cell research, euthanasia, and elsewhere in the letter as well, gay marriage. Dr. Hitchcock is back with us. Dr. Hitchcock, sorry about the little mix-up there.
Hello?
Are you there? He's not hearing us there.
Hello?
Okay. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Hitchcock's phone line is apparently experiencing some difficulty. The letter begins, "This coming November, we Americans will participate in one of the most important national elections in recent history. The president, senators, and congressmen who are placed in office by our voters will serve at a time when the issues that are critical to the very survival of our civilization will be at the top of the political agenda." Now, he enumerates these issues a little bit later. "As we prepare for these elections, I consider it my duty as your bishop to write to you in these matters so that you might go to the polls this fall with well-informed consciences." It's more than just bishoply advice for his people on how they ought to vote. He goes on to talk about banning from communion those who would do this, and I assume this would include even the possible president-to-be, Senator John Kerry. What do you think about this? Is this an act of courage, or is this a bishop overstepping his bounds? The Roman Catholic politicians who have taken up this issue and who have decided to set themselves against their church on the issue of life say, oh, it's a separation of church and state. Well, the bishop also responds to that as well. Dr. Hitchcock?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Now we have a two-way communication
going
on.
Well, I hope so, yes.
We just hope that it lasts. I want to read a statement again. This is the heart of the paragraph, the heart paragraph from the letter from the bishop, and have you parse it for us, if you would.
Sure.
He says, "Any Catholic politicians who advocate for abortion, for illicit stem cell research, or for any form of euthanasia, ipso facto place themselves outside full communion with the Church and so jeopardize their salvation." And he goes on to expand that to include those Catholics who vote for them as well. What is the bishop saying?
Well, I think he's made his position here quite clear. And what he's stressing here, I believe, is the matter of objective morality. You know, sometimes people will put it in terms of, well, the bishop threw him out of the church, or it's like a arbitrary ruling that comes down from the person who is in charge. And I think what Bishop Sheridan is saying here is right and wrong is an objective thing. If you do wrong, then you have automatically put yourself outside the church. You know, if even if the authorities themselves don't pronounce on it, maybe they don't even know about it, a proper understanding of conscience would lead you to realize that you're not entitled to participate in communion.
Now, Dr. Hitchcock, what is the scope in terms of jurisdiction? The bishop here can speak with authority within his diocese. His words have any power outside Colorado Springs?
He would have no authority in any other diocese. It's interesting, a number of bishops are beginning to speak up on this question. A very strong statement recently from Bishop Thomas Wensky of Palm Beach, Florida. And a little bit here about, you might say, a bit of church politics. There's a committee under Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington that's supposed to be studying the question. One of his spokesmen had said a few weeks ago, oh, we may not even come out with a statement until after the election. So I think what we're seeing is individual bishops who are saying, look, this has got to be addressed now, and what good will it do to come out with it after the election? So it seems to me that almost every day we're seeing more bishops coming out and making statements.
The American Life League has recently run at least one ad in the Washington Times and elsewhere in the Washington, D.C. media that names McCarrick by name and criticizes him as the chairman of that committee, but also as the Bishop of Washington, D.C. for permitting pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians to continue to commune in his jurisdiction.
Right. Yes, that seems to be the case, and I think it would be hard to avoid the conclusion that Bishop Cardinal McCarrick would like to dodge the issue. He says in one of his statements, well, I've got friends on both sides of the aisle, meaning both both Republicans and Democrats, and pretty clearly, I think the American bishops are probably pretty well divided on the issue, those who want to take a strong stand and those who don't. So what we're now seeing is individual bishops going it on their own, if that's what they think they have to do.
How do you dodge the issue? There's a very real possibility that a pro-choice, civil union presidential candidate could be occupying the White House a year from now.
Well, that's quite correct. And I think in broader terms, in many ways, what ought to be a primary issue in the minds of people is appointments to the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, which will, for years to come, will control issues like abortion, like euthanasia, like homosexual marriage, like stem cell research, like any number of other things. People tend to not notice that so much in elections. They may tend to concentrate on economic issues or foreign policy issues, but to vote for a candidate for office like Senator Kerry, who's made it very, very clear what kind of judges he's going to appoint, is to determine the fate of the United States for the next generation. So I don't think, you know, that this is something where people can be indifferent.
Is this a stronger statement than even the one made by newly come Archbishop Raymond Burke here in St. Louis?
I believe it is. Bishop Sheridan was a St. Louis priest, as you probably know, went to Colorado Springs, I think, about 2 years ago, before Archbishop Burke arrived. Archbishop Burke, I think, has not spoken of voters, and that is what makes Bishop Sheridan's statement significant. Now, of course, Bishop Sheridan will not know how people voted unless they tell him. Obviously, he's not threatening here mass excommunication. Voting is a confidential matter, but what he's saying to the voter, I think, is, look, your conscience should tell you to do the right thing. Even though the bishop may not know how the person is voting, how can you in good conscience do this?
He also writes, quote, "The church never directs citizens to vote for any specific candidate. The church does, however, have the right and the obligation to teach clearly and fully the objective truth about the dignity and rights of the human person." Is that really the broader issue here when bishops come out and say the reason that we will say no communion for Roman Catholic lawmakers is because we are fulfilling our teaching office in the church?
Yes, I think that is what they're saying here, that after all, we have a right to speak up on moral issues. I guess if you wanted to draw a fairly fine line, the church could say it would be immoral for you to vote for a candidate who espouses immoral positions. That doesn't tell you that you have to vote for his opponent. So, in other words, if the bishops are seen as saying don't vote for Senator Kerry, that doesn't necessarily translate into vote for President Bush. That may be seemed like a fairly fine distinction, but I think it's probably a real one.
he includes same-sex marriage as an issue upon which he is willing to deny communion both to lawmakers and voters.
Yes, he did, and he also included stem cell research, which is regarded by, I think, most competent officials here as, in fact, a form of abortion, or it involves it. So he has, well, as I say, these issues are going to be determining what the next generation of American society is like. These are issues which are, to a great extent, going to be determined in the courts. They will be determined also, to some extent, by presidential policy. And it would be derelict, I think, on the part of any religious leader not to notice these things as we come up to the election.
Now, I know that there are a large number of bishops in America, but as you peruse the horizon, Bishop Raymond Burke is one. Of course, Sheridan has now added his name. There are a few that are kind of iffy on the issue. Do you see anyone else stepping up, especially if this committee that's supposed to decide this issue does forestall their deliberations until after the November election? Do you see any others who are likely to step up and follow suit?
I think there have been a steady stream, actually. Let me get in a little commercial here. My wife has an organization called Women for Faith and Family. They have a website where they are keeping track of this. And if I'll give you very quickly, www.wf-f.org. And there, it's on. They're updating it virtually every day in terms of new statements by bishops and bishops who are saying things. And I would guess it's up now to about a dozen or so who have made significant public comments. And as I say, the surprising thing is really in a way new ones all the time. You know, just Bishop Sheridan only just a couple of days ago.
Is the pressure mounting on the bishop who presides over the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, obviously an informal organization within the church hierarchy, but is the pressure mounting upon Wilton Gregory of Belleville to also come out and at least say something about this?
I would think there would be. The way the bishops' conference works, that would never be public. You would never have any bishop coming out and criticizing the president of the conference, or, you know, telling the president of the conference what he thinks he should be doing. But I would be very surprised if there wasn't some kind of pressure about this behind the scenes. And I would guess that there are bishops who perhaps don't like what Bishop Sheridan is saying, who would then want the conference to come out with an official statement that would be considerably weaker, let's say, than what Bishop Sheridan is saying. And so quite possibly for that reason, there will be no statement. There have been complaints from Catholics for a long time that the bishop's bureaucracy, when elections come around, will put out a list of 20 items which they say are very important, and abortion just gets buried. It's one of 20. So you can justify voting for just about any candidate who you find one who's going to be on your side on one of these 20 issues. I think some of the bishops that are coming out now with very strong statements are attempting to get around the impression sometimes that their own bureaucrats give to the public.
How much of the iceberg are we seeing? And I'm thinking about the rank-and-file Roman Catholic parishioners. Where do they stand vis-a-vis their church on the issues of life?
Well, I'm afraid we have to say it's very much divided. The polls will show a pretty high percentage of Catholics, I mean, not a majority, but a fairly high percentage, who think abortion is okay under certain circumstances. Now, then you get to the question of how do you define a Catholic? If you get into the question of regular church attenders, and this is true in all the denominations, I think, then you see people becoming much more orthodox on the subject. A lot of the people who say I'm a Catholic and I'm pro-choice are people who never go to church. And how will Catholics react to the position of the bishops? Well, some people say this could backfire. You know, people are going to say, well, nobody's going to tell me how to vote. Well, obviously some people will say that. On the other hand, I think that a serious Catholic, when he hears the bishop saying this, is going to think, well, you know, I've really got to go back and give this serious consideration.
We talked recently with Father Richard John Newhouse, and he pointed out several times in our conversation that this is not a sectarian issue. This is not a Roman Catholic only issue. This is a pan-denominational issue in the church. Do you concur?
Yes, I certainly do. I mean, I think that the dividing line in American religion in many ways is between, roughly speaking, people say liberal conservative, or you could say orthodox and modernist, and that is it's just not the moral issues here like abortion, but it would be accepting the historic creeds, accepting the authority of the scriptures, and so on. And that does cut across denominational lines, and that I think that's absolutely true.
How will this eventually resolve itself? And you have made a life's work of studying the history of the church based upon the lessons of history. Do you see some sort of a hard and fast resolution to this within the American Catholic Church?
No, I don't. Because there could conceivably be a consensus position that the bishops themselves arrive at. There will be an official statement issued in the name of the American bishops to which they will all effectively subscribe. But again, you know, in terms of what Catholics in general think and believe, it's a fairly divided church, as are most of the churches. So I think it is going to continue to be a disputed issue as long as it's a disputed issue in the larger society.
What about global Catholicism? Are there lessons to be taken from the Roman Catholic Church in other regions or other nations who have already dealt with this issue?
Well, I don't think it's an issue that has been, you know, abortion is not an issue that has been resolved anywhere other than in the sense of its having been made legal. The pattern in global Catholicism is, again, like that of religion in general, pretty strong, particularly in Africa, weak in Western Europe, somewhere in between in Eastern Europe. And you go around the globe, and it varies considerably from one region to another. I'm not sure about Africa with regard to abortion, but Africans, as you probably know, this has come up in the Anglican Church, are very much opposed to the homosexual movement. And Africans, I think, in general, tend at this point to be pretty morally and religiously conservative.
Finally, with only a minute, Dr. Hitchcock, I would like you again to explain one of the lines from the letter from Bishop Sheridan of Colorado Springs. He's talking about the right to life. He says, "There is, however, one right that is inalienable, and that is the right to life. This is the first right. This is the right that grounds all other human rights. This is the issue that trumps all other issues." What is he saying?
Well, of course, it's the obvious point that if you're not alive, you don't have any other rights. You know, it is sort of ironic in our culture that people who will fight for the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to choose, and yet freedom, yet the right to life is not to them important. I mean, you have the contradiction, the recent abortion march in Washington of women carrying or saying, "I'm marching here because my mother didn't have the right to abort." And you scratch your head and say, "Now, wait a minute, are you saying you wish your mother had aborted you?" And how could you be there marching on behalf of a woman's right to choose if your mother had not respected your right to life?
Dr. Hitchcock, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for being patient with our technical difficulties.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Peter LaBarbera about gay marriage and the possibility of that issue taking root in Illinois.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths into the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly contributor to Issues, Etc. To find out how you can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, check out page 8 of the latest Issues, Etc. journal, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation: grace, faith, scripture, for the sake of Christ alone. Here we stand. Issues, Etc., and you.
Now this Global Minute highlights Christians in India who personally take great interest in their Hindu friends and neighbors. They visit as many homes as they can. Pray for India. Evangelists and Bible college students with India Evangelical Mission patiently made their way through the villages in a key area, asking families to attend a crusade. Up to 25,000 families were personally asked. The crusade was held a few months ago, and now local churches are helping people who want to ask more questions about Christ. Bible college students with IEM also learn about personal burdens and concerns of the families they meet. Conversations can easily turn to Christ's love as the students minister to deep spiritual needs. Pray for evangelists and Bible college students to meet people wanting to know more about Christ. Get a free brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Occasionally on the Lutheran Hour, I spoke against homosexuality, and that brought criticism from some conservative religious parents of practicing gays. They lashed out at me, torn between parental love and the conviction that there are some absolute truths by which we should live, and homosexuality is not one of them. Their anguish epitomizes our divided society. A 5th century critic of Greek religion, Xenophanes, said, "If the ox could paint a picture, his god would look like an ox." In today's cultural crisis, some paint a laid-back god of indulgent love. Others paint a moralistic god, a sheriff hunting down the bad guys. What's the picture for these anguished parents? God is not divided. God is one, Deuteronomy 6:4, and this undivided God is love, 1 John 4:8. He is, as Jesus paints him in the parable of the prodigal son, a waiting father. He lets us go our self-chosen way, even if wrong, but he's always watching and waiting for our children, his children, to come back to the ways of married love, taught by the Bible and long accepted as the definition of marriage in Western civilization. There is no comfort in society's imaginations about God, but there is comfort for parents, as you see in the Bible, God watching and waiting for your child.
When you think about the theology of glory, you may think that this is the theology that looks to God as a glorious human being, that he is the one who has glory. And the theology of the cross is where you got to do a lot of sacrifices and crucifying yourself in order to get to heaven. Well, those are almost the exact opposites of what the theology of glory means and the theology of the cross.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Coming off that conversation with Dr. James Hitchcock, he did mention a website there in the midst of our conversation wherein, if you want to, you can go and see and track the statements on the part of Roman Catholic bishops on the issue of pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians. That is a website run by his wife, Helen Hull Hitchcock. It's Women for Faith and Family, and the website is www.wf-f.org. That's wf-f.org. For the next 10 minutes or so, we're going to find out whether or not, now that the issue has been at least resolved for now in Massachusetts legally about gay marriage, whether or not Illinois stands to also face exactly the same kind of legal issue as well. We talked about Missouri yesterday. Peter LaBarbera joins us. He's executive director of the Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellen, Illinois. Then in about 10 minutes, we're going to be talking with Pastor Joe Fisher, spend some time speaking with him. He has been fighting a battle for 3 years with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections on the issue of whether or not prison inmates should be able to receive wine when receiving the Lord's Supper. That conversation comes up in about 10 minutes. Peter LaBarbera, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thank you.
Has the stage been set in any way whatsoever in the state of Illinois to consider or to go in the same direction as Massachusetts on the issue of gay marriage?
Well, if you listen to the homosexual lobby, yes, but the reality is no. There's a very clear law in Illinois passed in 1996, which says very, very clearly that marriage is between one man and one woman, It says same-sex couples are not allowed to get married, and it also says that the public policy of the state of Illinois is real marriage, true marriage between one man and one woman. And so the gay lobby is trying to say, oh, look, we've got to have marriage now because they have it, but nothing of the sort is true, and that's what we're fighting at Illinois Family Institute, to keep marriage as it's always been right here in Illinois.
Now, it sounds as though the DOMA statute, the Defense of Marriage statute, in Illinois is a bit stronger than even those in other states.
Well, it's pretty well written, although it was interesting to hear the lesbian attorney who argued the Massachusetts case and won that one for the gay side. She was trying to say that because Illinois law does not use the term void as applied to homosexual couples, that somehow the Illinois law is not as strong. And so you see how they're trying to use any tactic they can to say that somehow so-called homosexual marriage is ambiguous, but it's really not. The law is very clear here in Illinois.
Okay, so let's take the hypothetical and perhaps, sad to say, not so hypothetical situation. A lesbian couple from Illinois take a brief trip up to Massachusetts to receive there a marriage license. They are married there in Massachusetts immediately after reception of the license.
And we should say illegally, though, because they're not supposed to be married from out of state.
Yes, I want to get to that in a second. But let's say for the sake of argument, they do this, as so many are, we're reading about in the paper. They return to Illinois. Would the law that you just talked about here in Illinois basically require the state to not recognize their marriage?
Absolutely. They would not be recognized, just like civil unions from Vermont are not recognized today.
Okay, now let's go back to the point you just made in the midst of the question, and that is the illegality of what that scenario I just talked about. How is that so?
Yes, Governor Romney in Massachusetts has tried to enforce a 1913 law which says that marriages that are not recognized in other states would not be, people from those states would not be allowed to get married in this state. Now, Illinois' law is very clear, and so according to that law, no couple from Illinois should even be able to go to Massachusetts and get married unless they had taken up residency in Massachusetts. And of course, even then, it wouldn't be a real marriage. It's sort of a legal marriage, but in reality, it's not really marriage.
All right. What is the position of the current governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, on the issue of marriage, gay marriage?
As I understand it, Blagojevich is trying to have it both ways. He's saying that he's opposed to so-called gay marriage, but he's in favor of sort of civil unions and giving basically the same treatment that married couples do and calling it something else. And we're saying that's basically gay marriage by another name, which is why we also oppose civil unions, and we fought for a constitutional amendment here in Illinois. We're trying to get one passed which would not recognize either so-called gay marriage or the gay civil unions.
And what are the prospects of that amendment, realistically?
Well, Madigan killed it. The House Speaker, Mike Madigan, killed the amendment, even though it was immensely popular. But it has to be considered next year, which is the good news. We'll be pushing hard for it next year.
What about the legislature, both House and Senate in the state of Illinois? Where do they seem to stand on this issue, and also the courts?
Well, we didn't have as many sponsors as we would have liked in the state legislature for our amendment. Of course, it never even got to committee, thanks to Mike Madigan. So we think there's a lot of support out there. It was bipartisan. We have Democrats who are for the amendment. The problem is, of course, the Democratic leadership is stopping it. So it sort of puts Democrats in a hard place, those of them that are pro-family. In Washington, we have a few sponsors to the federal amendment to protect marriage, but not nearly as many as we'd like to see from the Illinois delegation.
There was, of course, everyone now is aware, a rash of people jumping the gun legally in California, in Oregon, in Arizona, elsewhere. Have anyone been showing up in the state of Illinois to get marriage licenses as gay couples?
Well, a few homosexual activist groups are trying to create a crisis. For example, right now, today, some homosexual groups went in to demand a marriage license, and apparently they were told no, and they refused to move, and so they were arrested. And so they're trying to create a crisis here that would force people to give these licenses, but this is against Illinois law, and we're not going to allow it.
Finally, what role would a federal amendment to the Constitution banning gay marriage, at least the one that's presently being talked about, what role would that play in this whole issue?
Well, I think the purpose of the federal one is to guard against these federal judges, especially, who might decide, just like Roe v. Wade was decided over 30 years ago, that there is somehow to create this national so-called right to homosexual marriage or homosexual civil unions. And so that's the biggest reason for the federal amendment, in my mind, is that these judges are out of control in the United States, and there has to be guidance put on them, so to speak, because otherwise they just make up law and they make up constitutional, so-called constitutional rights whenever they want. And so we're trying to protect against that.
If the issue of gay marriage comes to the voters in the state of Illinois, where do you think they will fall down on this issue?
I predict Illinois voters would pass a marriage amendment that protects marriage as one man, one woman. Whether we'll get the two-thirds necessary, I don't know. But I tend to think that if Illinois citizens can get beyond the liberal media, and that's a big problem, but if they can get beyond the liberal media and just think for themselves, they will stand behind marriage as it's always been between one man and one woman. And if I could say so, too, we do have a petition on our website at illinoisfamily.org. We have a petition for people who want to support our amendment and support the definition of marriage, and you can just download it from the website at illinoisfamily.org.
Very briefly, you mentioned the media. What role do you think it's been playing in this issue so far this year?
Well, the media is playing a civil rights issue. They've almost gotten lockstep behind the gay propaganda line, and it's very sad to see because our polling data shows that
And Peter LaBarbara just left us due to lack of power. Peter LaBarbara, he's executive director of the Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Their website, he mentioned before, and there at the website, a petition for Illinois residents on this issue, illinoisfamily.org. That's illinoisfamily.org. It's the website for the Illinois Family Institute. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Pastor Joe Fisher. He's pastor of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in West Bend, Wisconsin. The question being raised, now this isn't new for him, but perhaps you just read about it in USA Today, should prison inmates be permitted to drink wine when receiving the Lord's Supper? Now normally, and common sense would dictate this, alcohol is prohibited inside of a prison, of course. However, and this is not only an issue for Lutherans, but for the vast majority of Christians, participation in the Lord's Supper entails wine, bread, and wine. We're going to find out about that battle that he's been undergoing for 3 years with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections in order to be able to bring the Lord's Supper as Christ instituted it to prison inmates in the state of Wisconsin. Pastor Joe Fisher, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you, Todd. And I'm a longtime listener and a longtime fan of the show. Greatly appreciate the work and the outreach that you do, and it helps me, as I'm not always able to keep up with the current events the way I would like, and sometimes I can just catch your show and be brought back up to date. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and we're hoping you can reciprocate here and bring us up to date. When did this 3-year battle begin for you about wine in the prison system?
Well, it began for me, I guess we'd say, at my ordination vow, because I took a vow that I would uphold what Scripture teaches, and also the positions of our church body. And our church body has restricted the Lord's Supper to wine only in both Senate Convention in 2001 and District Convention in 94 when I came to the district. So the ability to use anything other than wine has been restricted vocally in resolutions to the Senate. However, the Lord used wine on Monday, Thursday, as you well know, in the Lord's Supper. It happened that 3 years ago, a person who was actually transferred to my membership, who had been incarcerated in a state prison, was then relocated to West Bend, and then after becoming a member of Pilgrim, had his parole revoked. And then visiting him in the prison, desired greatly to receive the Lord's Supper, and I had told him that that wasn't possible because the chaplain overseeing the prison, which was of a Reformed denominational background, had argued with me and clearly stated that only grape juice could be used, or if I would like, I could bring wine in and consume it in front of him. I stated, I'm neither Roman Catholic or Reformed. I'm Lutheran, and I would like to be able to do it properly according to my beliefs. I don't see where 1 ounce of wine would be considered an intoxicating beverage. I even offered to cut the wine with water, a 50-50 cut, and that was still considered intoxicating liquor according to the state of Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. So I saw no other avenue other than to work through the state assembly and the state senate. Otherwise, we would have to go to court, and I'd rather not waste time or money that way.
All right, tell us about the avenue that this issue took through the legislature in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, I'm truly blessed. The Lord provides, you know, what you need, and right here in West Bend, my community, Representative Glenn Grothman, who is a member of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, and our daughter congregation is our state representative and the majority whip at the state Senate, the state assembly. It turns out that at the state Senate is a Senator Leibham, and he's from Sheboygan, and he also is Missouri Synod Lutheran. Both are the co-chairs of the Rules Committee for the state of Wisconsin. I started working through with Representative Grothman, who contacted the Department of Corrections and requested that they review their policy based on the law that restricts intoxicating beverages on the prison grounds, that they review their policy of interpreting that to exclude the use of wine for communion when a pastor would be bringing it to his own members. They wrote him back with a view that, well, if they allowed me to come in with wine, then they'd have to allow other denominations or other religions to come in with their practices, some of which would use drugs that, you know, cause all kinds of things, and they would have problems housing the wine, and we've gone through the process of asking. I'm not asking for them to hold mass services. I'm asking to be able to come visit my own member and bring him what he desires, which is the certainty of the forgiveness of his sins, not only through the spoken word, but through that word joined with the visible elements of bread and wine that bring the body and blood of Christ, and the comfort of being joined to Christ, which assures me of my salvation.
Now, this has got to have been somewhat frustrating, not only dealing with fellow clergy who simply, out of their ignorance of what God's word teaches, fail to see the importance of administering the sacrament according to Christ's institution. Have you found any allies among fellow clergy along the way in your struggle to bring the Lord's Supper to this inmate?
Well, in the Missouri Synod, certainly have, but it was kind of interesting that the Wisconsin Catholic Conference, after our hearing on April 28th before the Rules Committee, issued immediate release, a statement supporting my rights and the pastors in the Missouri Senate's rights to bring communion properly to their members. So the Wisconsin Conference of Catholics has put their support behind us. The only clergy we've had that have spoken against us have been from another Lutheran church body, which I would say, as the person put it themselves, has a much looser view of interpreting the scriptures and the confessions, and I'll leave their words to speak for themselves.
Now, explain again for our listeners, the Roman Catholics really did not have to support you in this fight because they have a protocol for bringing the Lord's Supper. Would you explain that to us?
Well, let me explain it this way. When I teach my confirmands about the Lord's Supper, I explain it to them this way, and I think it's a beautiful illustration that was I read in a 1930s Concordia pulpit. The Roman Catholic, in their belief in the Lord's Supper, believe in transubstantiation, and if we use an electrical wire, when the light switch is switched, the Roman Catholic understanding would be that the wire becomes electricity. that it becomes the body and blood of Christ. And in their understanding, they've also allowed for you to receive the sacrament in one kind. So you could just receive the bread, and the priest would then be able to consume the wine in your presence, but the inmate would not receive the alcohol. The Reform understand the Lord's Supper, if we're using the electrical wire, in the sense that when you flip the switch, all the wire does is remind you of electricity. You have no electricity, nothing really happens, but you're reminded that there's such a thing as electricity.
I love your analogy, Joe. Keep going.
The Lutheran understanding of the Lord's Supper is when the switch is flipped, the wire brings me the electricity, which would be the body and blood of Christ. And the beauty of that illustration is that it brings me light, and that light is Jesus Christ. That's the easiest understanding I know of the Lord's Supper. And according to our confessions, we have to receive it in both kinds. One is not enough.
Because Christ gave it in both kinds.
Because Christ gave it in both kinds. And I have to use wine because Christ used wine. As for the bread, Pieper, Fritz, Chemnitz, all of them say, as long as it's bread, okay? But then they go on and say, but it must be wine. In quoting Walther from Walther's Pastoral Theology, he says, a number of substitutes for wine are found among heretical sects. Some use water, others milk, honey, unfermented grape juice. But the church has not failed to declare all this to be improper and insisted on the use of true wine. Since no doubt can arise if we use genuine wine, the dignity of the sacrament demands that we refrain from experimenting with all fluids of which it is not certain whether they are or still are fruit of the vine. Since the Lord's Supper is something to bring comfort and certainty and the sureness of salvation to the soul of the believer, to tamper with that in any way, shape, or form that might bring a level of uncertainty to the recipient is ungodly.
Pastor Fisher quotes from C.F.W. Walther, who was the first president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What is at stake here? I'm not talking about the legal issue at stake, because we can get to that in a few minutes. Theologically, pastorally, what is at stake in this issue of being able to bring the Lord's Supper as Christ instituted it to Christians, wherever they may be, including in prison?
Well, what is at stake is the comfort that comes in the presence of Christ. The joy and peace that can be found in knowing that your sins are forgiven, the total rehabilitation of the sinner in the new creation, which is Christ. That's what is at stake when they're limiting and restricting or removing the full gifts of grace from someone.
Now let's talk about other laws that have bearing upon this. I read in the AP story that since August 2002, inmates at federal prisons have been permitted to receive wine as part of a religious ritual. Does that show a way legally for the resolution of this issue in Wisconsin?
Well, I would certainly hope that the ruling in 2002, that was referring to the Florida case, I believe, where an inmate who was Roman Catholic sued for the right to receive it in both kinds. And even though the Catholic faith allows for it to be received in only one kind, he still won as the Federal Court of Appeals overturned a lower court's ruling that it was illegal for him to receive it. The state of Wisconsin, when that was quoted to them at our hearing, the Department of Corrections kept pointing out that that's Florida's law, not Wisconsin, and has nothing to do with us. Ultimately, what can happen here is that if we can get the Department of Corrections to state their policy in writing, then the Rules Committee can remove their policy and change it.
Do they have their policy stated in writing?
No. All they have in writing is that intoxicating liquor is forbidden on prison grounds. They do not have their interpretation of the policy in writing. And from time to time, prisons have interpreted that policy differently, as some wardens have allowed for the pastors to bring the Lord's Supper properly, because this non-intoxicating liquor law has been on the books for some 30 years, yet I know numerous pastors who said they never had problems taking the Lord's Supper in before. It seems that when a Reformed brethren of the ilk that would use grape juice as a supplement, or if you will indulge me for a second, I was brought up in a denomination that was of the Reformed belief and was offered the Lord's Supper at church camps with pizza and soda pop and popcorn and Kool-Aid, because, you know, as long as it's a liquid and a solid, it really doesn't matter. Our Reformed brethren, some of which would find what I just said very distasteful in their own right, when they become chaplains over the prisons, tend to want to force the view of grape juice. I don't know if it's to justify their view of grape juice, or if they truly believe that bringing someone the Lord's Supper is going to cause them to be an alcoholic or not. I don't know.
I remember talking off air with someone recently, and they were talking about the practice of the Lord's Supper in the military chaplaincy.
Correct.
And they were saying ordinarily, in certain, especially in Islamic countries where alcohol is illegal, American service persons stationed there would have an exception through the chaplain's office for the Lord's Supper that was recognized there, and that although, yes, alcohol, the consumption of alcohol be illegal in the country when to honor their laws, there would be exceptions made there. And I see here at least in some sense a parallel, because this is not being used for amusement. It is not being taken in toward the end of intoxication, but as part of the institution of the Lord's Supper.
Well, this is the thing. The state of Wisconsin was bragging that the Department of Corrections has bragged that their institutions are now smoke-free. Okay? Part of the Indian religious practice is the smokehouse. The Department of Corrections then found themselves with a quandary. Upon going smoke-free, the Indians were asking for the permission to continue with the smokehouse. And the problem that they found was that people who hadn't been practicing the Native American Indian religions were becoming Native American Indian worshipers so that they could go and smoke. And they were afraid that if we started bringing real wine in for communion, then everyone would want to become a Lutheran so that they could receive the Lord's Supper and get a drink. I don't understand this process, but you would think that common sense would prevail, and I think Representative Grothman has been correct in saying that there's a lack of common sense right now at the Department of Corrections office on this issue.
Pastor Joe Fisher is our guest. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with him. Should prison inmates be able to drink wine when receiving the Lord's Supper? No one's arguing they should be able to just have a bottle in their cell. What we're talking about here is receiving the Lord's Supper in accord with Christ's institution. Pastor Joe Fisher is our guest. We'll be right back, and the second hour of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.